Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Esther Figueroa. Esther Figueroa, PhD, is a Jamaican independent filmmaker, writer, educator, and linguist with over 35 years of media productions, including television programming, documentaries, educational videos, multimedia, and feature film. Her activist filmmaking gives voice to those outside of mainstream media and focuses on the perpetuation of local and indigenous knowledge and cultures, the environment, social injustice, and community empowerment. Figueroa's films are screened and televised all over the world and taught at numerous universities. They include Jamaica for Sale, 2009, the award-winning feature documentary about tourism and unsustainable development. Her latest feature documentary, Fly Me to the Moon, 2019, is about modernity and the global aluminum industry. She recently created and co-hosted GEFF 2020, the first online film festival focused on global extraction. Her environmental novel, Limbo, 2013, was a finalist in the 2014 National Indie Excellence Awards for Multicultural Fiction. So first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Derek. And, you know, you're such an influence all over the world. I was interviewed the other day by a friend in Nepal who is part of the movement. And she became who she is because she read one of your books. So, you know, I have to thank you as well for all that you have done and all the people who have been inspired by you.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. You know, we are all holding hands across space and through time. So can you tell us about Jamaica and go back as far as you want in time?
Yeah, I'm going to go back pretty far, but before I do that, I just wanted to ask you, you've never been there, right?
No, I've never been farther into the Caribbean than the Keys.
Okay. Well, you're not far. You're pretty close. When you think of Jamaica, do you have a thought at all?
First thing that comes to mind is rainforest going down to beaches, and then probably coral reefs.
Okay.
Oh, and the second thing, honestly, the second thing, I hate to say this, but the second thing I think of is also slavery.
Okay. Well, okay. So rainforests going down to beaches and then coral would have been the way it was when Christopher Columbus got there in 1494, right? Currently, and I will get back to, I'll come back to this after I just give the basic history. We have, the Caribbean was, but particularly Jamaica, where a lot of the techniques for studying coral reefs started in the 40s. We were the first coral reefs to be studied and the first coral reefs to die of those being studied so intensely. And I use that as an example of kind of the insanity of science, right? That you would devote yourself for decades to study something and not stop its death. In fact, many of those scientists later came out and apologized. You know, they feel badly, but, you know, what's wrong in this picture? We can go back to talk about that. We're also going to talk about Coptic country and the threat of mining, and Coptic country is one of our last intact forests. So it's interesting that that's the idea you have of the place, because that's an idea that would have gone back about 500 years ago. Because the name Jamaica, which is the original name of the original people who are called, now we call them the Taino, supposedly the word Jamaica, which the Spanish would have heard it and then said Jamaica, not quite sure what the original pronunciation, but it's thought that it meant something like land of wood and water or land of many streams, right? And of course, that would be very important to Columbus and other colonists because water is so very, very important, especially if you're traveling around long distances trying to conquer the world. You need to get your ships in, get water on, etc. So a place with that much water, rivers, water, water, water requires forests. right? So yes, your idea would have been the original idea, because we would have had to have immense forests to be able to have that much water. So we're going to return to those issues after I just give a little kind of historical and geographical background, which I'll start with that right now. Jamaica is a small island. We're a little over 4,000 square miles, but we've had an immense role in the world, much bigger than our size, and that's both political and in creating wealth, modernity, and also culturally, of course, through our music, but also our movements for African liberation. We were very big in the apartheid movement, anti-apartheid movement. We were very big in black empowerment. The vast majority of Jamaicans are of African descent, and I'll explain why. And cultural, you know, also sports. We had the fastest man in the world, and we've had the fastest woman in the world. So for a small place, it's really been quite remarkable. We're the third largest of the Caribbean islands, and we're located very closely to Cuba and Hispaniola. Hispaniola is where Haiti and the Dominican Republic are. In my family, I have ancestry from Cuba, for example. But we've all, you know, we're all very close, and Jamaica and Cuba have had historical, you know, going back pre-contact, pre-conquistadores, you know, we've always been very, very close. And our relationship with Cuba, of course, has been this drama with the United States of America, with their absolutely hideous blockade of Cuba and the nonsense that's gone on with that island. And that has very much influenced our geopolitical relationships with the U.S., where in the 70s, for example, we tried to have a democratic socialist government. We tried to have some kind of distribution of wealth, because we were one of the most unjust and unequitable societies in the world. And we had a very close relationship with Cuba, and that led to the U.S. sending the CIA in and basically disrupting our society and getting rid of the government. So the Caribbean, even though we were a British colony, after being a Spanish colony, and we didn't remain, we're still in very close ties with these neighbors around us. So I mentioned Columbus coming in 1494. We were one of the islands that he first came to on that voyage. He was first in what is probably the Caicos Islands, Turks and Caicos, and probably the Bahamas, and then he came to us. So we became the property actually of his family. So that when he died, Jamaica became the property of his sons. We were under Spanish rule for about 178 years, and then English rule for about 37 years. And then we were under British rule for 255 years. And though we supposedly got political independence in 1962, the Queen of England is still titular head of Jamaica and represented by the Governor General. And this is not just Jamaica. I mean, Canada and Australia, that are huge countries, still have this situation for some strange reason. So the colonial continuities are very, very strong, including the fact that we still have a lot of colonial laws, including laws pertaining to mining, which we will get to a little later. Continuing the history, we weren't very important to the Spanish because we didn't have the kind of gold and silver that they were looking for, and they had conquered such huge, rich indigenous nations up and down the North, Central, and South America. So they weren't really, Jamaica was kind of a backwaters to them. They weren't that interested in it. Meanwhile, the English, this is, you know, starting in the 1500s, in particular, were trying to play catch up with the Spanish, and we became the center of the English and then the British Empire. And why this was because of our geopolitical placement in the Caribbean. We were directly in line, south of us is South America, is, excuse me, Central America. It's Panama and Honduras. And what, you know, there's stupid films like Pirates of the Caribbean, what are called pirates and buccaneers, were actually terrorists and thieves. And what they did was they left Jamaica, a place called Port Royal, which was the richest city in the world, and they would sail to these places and, you know, rape, pillage, ransack, steal the wealth, and they would also steal from, they would capture the Spanish galleons and steal the wealth that the Spanish had stolen from the indigenous people of these places. This wealth, this huge amount of wealth, was then invested in plantation agriculture, which could be seen as the first stages of industrialization in this period that we know of. Modernity was actually created in the Caribbean and Latin America through these industrial agricultural processes. And so in Jamaica, the plantations were primarily sugar. And so basically, the first kind of enslaved people by the English were the Irish. I don't know if you know the history of Cromwell and Ireland and whatnot, but the Irish were the first slaves brought to the Caribbean. They didn't do too well in the Caribbean. People from the north didn't do too well in the conditions, the tropical conditions. They died from diseases and that kind of stuff. The English, the Dutch, the French, the Belgians, the Spanish, the Portuguese, all of them had been involved in enslaving Africans and trafficking Africans. And so what began was this huge basic, genocide of capturing, trafficking, enslaving Africans. And so they were brought to Jamaica to make up for the indigenous people who had been enslaved and who had died, and for the Irish who were also not doing very well. So you basically had this amazing industrial plantation system where you had people working for no wages, which is basically the ultimate, if you take capitalism to its ultimate goal, you end up, right, with ultimate profit and no costs. You had what were then the highest technologies of manufacturing the sugar. You had steam, which was one of the highest technologies of the time. You had these huge, manufacturing type processes. You also had time management, the kind of things we think of now when we think of places like Amazon and, people working themselves, to injury and death. You have this thing of labor being people being worked and worked and worked for the benefit of a very few who were extraordinarily wealthy. Kind of thing at the time was to say as wealthy as a West Indian. That, of course, did not mean as wealthy as a West Indian of African descent, nor as wealthy as an Irishman. What it meant was as wealthy as a Scot or an Englishman who was in the business of slavery. And so this wealth that was generated, huge amounts of wealth from a place like Jamaica, which was the center of the empire, that wealth was then invested in British institutions, banking, insurance, philanthropy, huge estates, part of the removal of the Highlanders in Scotland and the removal, the shrinking of the commons and the taking away of the people's land to create these huge aristocratic land holdings, in Scotland, the removal of the Highlanders for these huge sheep farms that we probably think are normal. No, they're not. That all came from the wealth of plantation slavery in places like Jamaica. So this wealth was invested. That wealth and also the fact that the people had been removed from their rural holdings in places like Scotland and Northern England and whatnot, drove them into the cities, and also out into settlement, into the colonies, which created genocide in all these other places. That was what created the Industrial Revolution. That is what has led us not only to the ecocide that has created, you know, the so-called climate crisis and everything else, but that came from the wealth of such a small, tiny place like the Caribbean, like a place like Jamaica or Barbados, for example. And so we have this connectivity from then, from going way back, to how we get to where we are today through modernity and industrialization. And another thing was that is part of this connectivity was that sugar, you know, sugar became the addiction of the working classes who were slaving away in these awful conditions in factories and whatnot. The British and their tea, you know, with lots of sugar, et cetera, their sticky buns and all of that. All of that, you know, was also part of the capitalist system. So it's all very, very entwined. So when we talk about, you know, where does wealth come from and where does poverty come from, you know, people think of, you know, poor people and poor nations that, you know, they're that way because of some original sin or some curse, corruption, ineptitude, you know, whatever narrative people want to believe, you know, what Trump calls the shithole nations whose citizens he, you know, he doesn't want to migrate to the U.S. when in fact his ancestors came over from Germany, you know, and with the millions who died in the Nazi genocide, you might just easily describe Germany as a shithole because of that, right? So when people think of wealth, they think, you know, innovation, industry, hard work, good families, whatever, but wealth is actually stolen. The wealth of the rich nations has come from ecocide and genocide and slavery and extracting people in nature, right? So when Americans despair at the current political system and call the U.S. a banana republic, I have to laugh because it was the U.S. that created banana republics in the first place. It was United Fruit that went into places like Honduras and took over, and it was the U.S. that established dictators and overthrew progressive, democratically elected governments. So yes, the U.S. should know about fascism, dictatorship, authoritarian governments, and banana republics, and Americans shouldn't be surprised that their government is trying to be what it has forced others to be. So this thing of industrialization, when people think of Jamaica, they're not going to think of industrialization. They're going to have a beautiful image like you have, or if they've been there, or if they've, you know, kind of watched our tourism ads, they'll think of it as a place of recreation. You know, they'll think of it as a place of fun or chilling out. You know, you go there and smoke some weed, you know, dance to Bob Marley or whatever. They're not going to think about modernity. They're not going to think about industrialization. They're not going to think that we had anything to do with the plane that they're flying in, you know. They're going to think of maybe a place like Pittsburgh, you know, or some, you know, large city. And so, but actually the plane that they're flying in is connected to Jamaica because the plane that they're flying in is made of aluminum. And Jamaica was central to aluminum. We were the largest producer of bauxite and alumina, which are the two of the three processes that create aluminum. We were the largest producer, but we started in the 50s and we were the largest producer by the 60s. And we've had about 70 years of the aluminum industry in Jamaica. So, you know, that's a kind of broad sweeping overview, but I want to tie it into this notion of you might think of Jamaica as this beautiful kind of laid back place, but it's a deeply urbanized place, a deeply industrialized place, even if parts of it don't look that way.
So thank you so much for all of that. And I'm gonna ask you to go back for a second, and then I'll ask some sort of current questions. And the asking you to go back is, you've been talking about modernity, and can you define modernity?
Well, I can't define it because, you know, academics and...
Well, what do you mean by it then? Let's put it that
sure,
way.
Sure, exactly. What I mean by modernity is two things. One is a worldview, right? An attitude towards life and what matters and what's valued. And another thing is a kind of material reality, right? So if we start with the worldview of modernity, it's a notion of a centrality of the human being, right? And this is not a modern view. This goes back to certain kind of patriarchal religions, such as the ones that came out of Abrahamic traditions. So that would be Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. This notion that, you know, humans are gods, you know, chosen people, that kind of stuff. So it's this notion of a kind of human centrality, and then within that, there's a hierarchy, right? And white males are at the top of the hierarchy, and then you go down this pyramid and you get to what are considered kind of inert nature. You know?
So it's the great chain of being.
Excuse me?
The great chain of being.
Yes, right. You know, and you get down to things that don't matter, like dirt, right? Things that are the most important building blocks, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, never mind the fact that all terrestrial life is based on, all land life is based on soil. Without soil,
there is nothing, right?
Yeah,
and
nothing.
We call it dirt, right? Exactly. So you have this worldview. You also have this worldview that some people have traced to the so-called Enlightenment. This is kind of something that happened out of, in rejection of kind of, what shall we say, a kind of secularization of Europe at a particular time. And this Enlightenment notion then kind of gets to this role of man, because that's what it's called. And what matters, right? Well, it's kind of, what matters becomes work. You know, what you can produce. What matters is this kind of notion of the separation of the body and the mind is what matters. And so we start to, in worldview, we start to move further and further away from any notion of integration or belonging or being embedded in everything, right? The whole of everything that is all connected. And this is compacted with this notion of kind of this kind of aggressive culture that has to kind of always be in a state of progress, right? You know, if you think of this trope of every election, you know, is are you better off than your parents, right? What does that even mean? You know, but it's this notion of this ladder, because of this hierarchy, right? And because of this kind of notion of evolution, you have to be always progressing more and more and more. And when you look at the material side of that endless progression, then it's progressing more and more means that humans basically dominate more and more and more and more the landscape. You know, notions of civilization and value is, you know, you have the highest skyscraper, you know, you have the rockets that can go furthest into space. You have the most armaments, you know, you can kill the most people. So you have this worldview and this need for more and more materiality to prove that you're in a constant state of advancement. Now, within that, the concept of the modern, as opposed to the traditional or the indigenous or whatever you want to call it, pre-modern, in my mind, it's this notion of human entitlement, human centrality, and that in this notion of constant progress, constant development, is the notion that we must have a certain type and of standard of living that humans are entitled to, and it must keep increasing, increasing, increasing. And so when you think of a modernity, you think of our mobility, you think of speed, you think of comfort, you think of the fact that we can get from point A to B very, very quickly, that we can now, you know, look everything up on the internet or whatever and whatever. It's this sense of speed, of the collapsing of geography, the collapsing of anything really that is in the realm of physics and materiality that makes humans not central in the world.
So thank you for that. That was just beautiful. And now I know you did this before, but now that you've defined modernity, can you give us a a quick wrap-up. You earlier said that Jamaica was sort of central to modernity, and you gave a really good explanation of it. But now that you've defined modernity, can you come back and wrap that back up one more time? Do you see what I'm asking?
Sure, absolutely. It's not just Jamaica. It's the Caribbean and the Americas, which includes North America, because, of course, what we call now Canada and what we call the U.S. was all part of that process of colonialization. It's just that they then became the colonizers after that. So what it is that modernity and our notion of speed, mobility, accruing more and more and more each generation, progressing more than the generation before, getting further and further away from indigenous and traditional knowledges and behaviors and practices, you know, moving into space, you know, we're all going to be on Mars next. All of that requires a huge amount of extraction, right? Because for us to have all the things we do, and I'm sitting in a room right now, it's just covered, I mean, there's so much stuff in here, right? To have all of that, it has to be made from something. And it has to have people to make it. And you have to keep having more and more things to make. And, you know, and so it requires huge amounts of, you know, minerals and water and forests and trees and soil and everything to be then taken and made into something else. And so when, and it's, what happened was, you know, it had, you know, this had happened earlier in history in other ways, but it happened in a very particular and intense way at the end of the 14th century and the beginning of what was then the conquest of this part of the world that was called the New World. And the reason it started in the Caribbean was because that's the first place Columbus got to. After that, then he got to, you know, different parts of the Americas, and then the same followed with the English, the French, the Dutch, and everybody else. So if you think of it, why I say we're central to modernity is because the extraction that was needed for modernity came from these places. But not just that, the systems of white supremacy, the systems of racial capitalism, the systems of work, the industrialization of agriculture that then led to the industrialization of what we think of now as industry, the making, the manufacturing of things, all of that was started in the Caribbean and the Americas.
So before we get back to Jamaica, there's another question that has bothered me for decades, and that's, you know, you said so simply that the stuff that we have was made from something that came from somewhere and was made by someone.
Yes.
And can you, after I've written 25 books about this, can you help me understand why that is so hard for people to understand? Because that is essentially, that's 90% of my analysis right there. And just a couple days ago, I know Facebook's a cesspit, but I posted something on Facebook about this astronomer who thinks we can go out into outer space and why, and there'll be, you know, 800 million civilizations out there that we can have contact with. And I simply pointed out that any industrialized system that is capable of going into outer space will destroy its own planet, because in order to make all that stuff, you had to convert your living planet into these dead things that, and you have to get energy for it. And
yep.
There was a disappointing amount of pushback. And so here's the question. Why is it so difficult for people to understand that the couch they are sitting on was made somewhere out of stuff that was taken from the ground at that place and assembled by someone. And it's the same one. I'm sorry, one more thing, which is a lot of the mainstream environmentalists, in quotes, they talk about, you know, solar harvesting facilities as though the photovoltaics grow on solar trees. And
they grow on solar trees, don't they? Didn't you know that, Derek?
So why is this so hard to understand? I'm sorry. I know you're the interview subject, but I want to say one more thing.
We're having a conversation.
Is it,
Derek? It's not about understanding. And I see this is where we have such a problem when we think of, you know, why X, Y, or Z, right? We think if only people knew or something. No. And like you, you've written whatever number of books, I have made, you know, whatever number of films trying to convince people of X, Y, and Z. And often when I am, you know, the different activist films I make are often for a very, very specific thing that's happening, a very specific cause of an emergency, often with, you know, people on the ground, communities or activists or NGOs or whatever it is trying to communicate something, right? And so it's like, well, you know, if only people knew, right? I'm sorry. Most people know. It's not about not knowing. It's that we have bought into our entitlement, our comfort, and then, especially for liberals, okay? Especially for left liberals, we've bought into the innocence and virtuous narratives, okay? Which means I am innocent, and this is a very much an American narrative, right? Why don't want to deal with, you know, get hysterical about Black Lives Matter or whatever. Oh God, no. I mean, slavery was so long ago. They're still Native people. You know, we didn't kill them all. The innocence narrative says that other people and the way they think and the way they act, well, you know, that I am innocent because either I am not part of this historical narrative or I am virtuous, meaning I drive an electric car, you know, I eat organic food that I buy at, X, you know, we know the place, et cetera. And so it's other people are the problem, right? But mainly, we do not want to think about the fact that the chocolate we eat, that we might call Swiss, there are no, you know, no cocoa trees have ever grown in Switzerland, right? That our pleasures, the things we feel are necessary in our lives, our necessities, our pleasures, our comforts, are based on ecocide and genocide and the exploitation of other people. And some of us know that intimately because we ourselves are part of that chain of exploitation. But we still feel on some level entitled. Okay? So for example, I was at, there's a annual conference that has to do with Caribbean studies, and I was at one of them, for some reason, and, they're always held in these fancy hotels, you know, in some place in the Caribbean, and you have all these academics who are very critical of everything, you know, of, you name it, right? And they're staying at some, you know, resort. And there was this Black American female academic and, you know, trying to have a critique of, you know, staying in this resort and the workers and this kind of thing. And she just basically said, I've had a very bad year and I deserve this. Okay? This is someone who in her work would have solidarity, right? With people of African descent, would probably have, she's probably from, you know, a working class or somewhat oppressed, you know, background herself, would have some kind of solidarity with working class people somewhere. But that does not disrupt her right to have a vacation in the Caribbean and exploit people who work for very little to make her recreation. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it's not that you can't understand that the sofa you're sitting on is made of materials and it was made by somewhere in some factory that you might, you know, you might have worked in a factory. But that does not apply to you as an individual because you have to have that sofa. So how do you change human entitlement, individual sense of necessity? I remember once I've done a lot of work in marine conservation and issues around fisheries and stuff like that. And I remember the same thing, information. You know, in Jamaica, we're one of the most overfished countries in the world. And, you know, like I was telling you before, our reefs are dead and blah, 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 blah. And one of the last fishes that Jamaicans eat that other people in the Caribbean tend not to eat, though now they've started to, is what we call parrotfish. Parrotfish graze the reefs and are essential to the reefs. So, you know, we've tried campaigns, we've tried to stop people eating parrotfish. And again, a very educated, as you know, knows the facts. And she basically said, I have to eat fish, right, for her nutrition. So when everyone decides that their survival, however they define it, okay, whether it's subsistence survival to billionaire survival, I mean, billionaires rationalize why they have to be billionaires, right? You know, they couldn't have 1 cent less. It's the fact that as human beings, we are a narrative species. And we can tell ourselves any story we want to justify not changing.
That reminds me of Robert J. Lifton's big thing, which was that, or is that, before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is not, in fact, atrocious. But,
absolutely.
But virtuous. He called a claim to virtue.
Virtuous. Exactly. 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 And so you have people all being virtuous, claiming to have completely competing ideologies. So what you just described, right? From scientists saying it's okay to mine the seabed and, you know, mine the oceans and destroy the oceans because that's better than the land, right? To people saying we must leave Earth and go to galaxy and Mars and whatnot, that that's imperative. And we've always, you know, been, you know, and that's why I hate when botanists and environmentalists and others use the word colonizing when they talk about plant species. They love to talk about plant species colonizing somewhere because that then makes it seem like humans colonizing Mars or the moon or wherever is just part of inevitable evolution, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. So, you said a moment ago that how do we individually change those I don't remember the exact way you ended the sentence, but change those, not the value systems, but the demands, the needs, the whatever we're going to call them. Demands is better than needs. But you emphasized the word individually. And why did you emphasize the word individually as opposed to A, not emphasizing it, or B, saying, how do we collectively change this? Do you see what I'm asking?
Sure. A collection is made up of individuals. Okay? And each individual has to make changes for there to be a collective change. So when we speak in terms of aggregates of whomever, that aggregate is made up of individuals who all have a narrative about themselves and their needs. whether they have too little or whether they have too much. So until I decide to change, until you decide to change and make changes, then telling someone else to change is kind of beside the point. So lead by example, right? So it's not just that. It's that one has to somehow, I don't know, Derek, what was the moment in your life that made you think the way you think? What were the moments? What led to it?
Well, yeah, I couldn't answer the first one because it wouldn't be a moment. It was moments.
Right.
Well, there was my father's violence that I didn't articulate this as a kid, but in my bones I was asking if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? This is destructive behavior. And, that's a question that I've been asking through all my books. I mean, that's the question we're talking about in this interview. Because none of this is making us happy, and it's destroying the entire planet. So there's that. And then when I was seven, they put in a subdivision next to where I lived, and it killed off the meadowlarks and the cottonwood trees and the grasshoppers. And I remember thinking as a 7 or 8 year old, however old you are in second grade, if they keep doing this, there will be no place for the meadowlarks to live. And so that's the language I did have. The language I have now, but I didn't have then, is you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And then we can go through other ones too. But the real point is yes, I had that realization, but there's a question of why I had that realization and other kids the same age in that neighborhood may not have.
Exactly.
Why did they not care about the meadowlarks?
Well, and not just that. Some people looked at that and said, great, right?
Right.
We're finally, this isn't a swamp anymore or whatever, right? So that is the thing, right? We're all touched. That's why I use the word individually, because we're all touched in different ways. There are different things that inspire us. There are different things that move us. There are different things that make us think, oh, wait. There's another way to be. For one example, for me, there were many different things. But one of it was, I'm the youngest of seven children, and one of my brothers, who was at that time very much kind of counterculture, this would have been in the 60s, I was of an age where conventionality, I was about nine, was very important, to be like other kids, and my family was very weird. And he basically told me, straight up, no, you don't. You don't have to do any of those things, There, he gave me permission to leave convention and to never be ashamed of not being part of the majority. So all I'm saying is for everybody, it's different because everybody tells themselves different stories and everybody has some different type of makeup, psychological makeup in themselves. And of course it's collective. Of course it's based on all sorts of things we have no control of. We were born into a place and time we had no control of. That is part of a historical stream we had no control of, right? So of course, ultimately it's collective. But the collective doesn't change. Individuals change. That's why you can have laws, in either direction. You can have laws that are completely fascist and the people go, not doing it. You can have laws that are, totally progressive and the people go, not doing it. So, unfortunately, it's very intricate why at a given time, and it's not forever. I know all sorts of people who are very radical at a certain point in their life and, very whatever, whatever, and then, that lasted 3 years, 4 years, whatever. It's very hard as a social animal to not find some kind of belonging and some kind of comfort in being like others and getting good feedback from that in whatever form it takes. And sometimes it's abuse, but some people get used to that and think it's a normal.
I just recently learned of the ASH experiment, and this is, I can't believe it took me until now to learn about it. It's evidently very famous, and it's the one where they put one subject in a room, and he thinks that there's like five people who are all subjects, but the other four are actors. And they have, they show them a piece of paper with four lines on it, one on the left that is a certain length, and then on the right, one of the others is the same length, and one of the others is obviously shorter and one's obviously longer. And they say, which of these are the same length on the right? And the four actors all give the wrong answer. And what happens is that the first time through, the subject gives the correct answer, and by the third or fourth time, they're agreeing with everybody else. It's just, it's extraordinary.
Exactly.
Which is how we can have everybody say, oh, we can keep having an infinite expansion on a finite planet, and everybody else just goes along with it because that's what everybody's saying.
Well, especially everyone's saying it, right? So you have it said in so many different ways, right? So you have this, you know, the supposed progressive left, which in America is like, you know, in the rest of the world, you know, the whole notions of left and right make no sense anymore, right? But, you know, the supposed progressive left saying, you know, Green New Deal, right? You have, environmentalists, like you're saying, you know, selling, you know, using the word harvest, you know, for a completely toxic, solar, installation, you know, calling it a farm, calling it, you know, all those things are euphemisms, right? That's part of the narrative, you know? And why, you know, the book that, you know, the three of you have written is so powerful is because it takes those euphemisms, right? And those ways of talking and details, like, no, it's not a farm, you know? No, these metals come from here. These are how they're made. This is where the waste goes, you know, these are the animals they kill, et cetera, right? So it's very important to produce over and over and over counter-narratives, other narratives, but in many different ways, because the hegemonic narrative, the narrative that's being said over and over and over of human entitlement and centrality and all of that, is being said in so many different ways. It's being said from a certain kind of religious perspective. It's being said from a certain kind of ideological or economic or social or political, et cetera, right? So, you know, when you have everyone saying it, then everyone who can identify, if Bernie Sanders says it, I'm with him. You know, if Donald Trump says it, I'm with him. You know, whomever it is, you know, if the head of TNC says it, I'm with them, you know, right? So whoever says it, you can find your tribe.
Right. So we're getting very close to the end, and I want to say two things and then ask a question. One thing I want to say is that I did not ask you more about the reefs or fisheries or the bauxite because I would love to have you back again to talk specifically about those.
That'd be great.
And then you've just done this wonderful weaving of history and place and socioeconomic momentum. And just how would you like to sum up, if somebody, two things. One is, if somebody was to tell a friend of theirs, oh, I heard this great interview today, it was about this, can you sum it up for them? What's the point of what you're saying? And the other question would be, what do you want actually people to do with with this analysis, this great analysis that you're giving, and same with your films, what do you want people to actually go out and how do you want them to be different or to be different in the world?
Well, I mean, the first one, I mean, we've started having a conversation, a great conversation. We haven't gotten to the details of, like you said, we'll talk another time, hopefully, about the whole issue around aluminum and bauxite. I mean, I just wrote a 95-page rebuttal for an environmental impact assessment for mining in Jamaica that will probably go through. I'm going to have to do court cases. We're going to have to do actions on the ground. I mean, someone just needs to blow up these, machines.
I would love to do, like, I just did an interview yesterday with somebody about a specific lithium mine in Nevada, and he went through the process they're going to go through legally, et cetera, et cetera. So I would love to do just one where you talk about that entire process that you're going through.
I'd love to talk about that. Because, one thing that I think you agree with is that environmentalists have focused on things like environmental impact assessments as if, instead of stopping, if 40 years ago we didn't develop these procedures, of so-called good governance and transparency and corporate responsibility and instead stopped these things from happening at all, right?
Yep.
But instead, we went the way of oversight and, all of that, right? And so we just gave more and more power to governments and corporate entities and make it more and more difficult to stop it.
I was just going to say that, as Thomas Lindsay says, the permitting process is about permitting.
Exactly. Exactly. It's not about banning or stopping, right? So, I'd love to do another thing. In terms of people, I'm not, even though I do, I'm a propagandist, that's what I do. I create propaganda for specific things in all senses of that, in the good sense. I'm not big on telling other people what to do or think or be. All I can say is that and I said this recently in my chat with my friend in Nepal, but I'll say it again to be repetitious. We need to stop the innocence narrative, We need to stop the virtuous narrative. We need to stop through the exceptionalism. And like you've done in your book, we need to be clear-eyed and admit in all of its horrendous detail what everything actually is and what is actually happening. And so, again, there's no point pointing at someone else and saying, over there they're doing that. So just start with yourself. Where are you positioned in this moment in history, and how did you get there? And how does that relate to the peoples and lands and creatures and everything around you? And how does it happen globally, people are very interested now in ancestry, right? And getting their DNA and all that kind of stuff. Maybe that would be a fun place to start. If you're into that kind of stuff, go for it. How, given who you are at this, and where it came from, learn a little bit, learn a bit. Oh, how did these people get from there to there? Settler, maybe settler colonialism, maybe slavery, maybe genocide, maybe ecocide. Who knows? Learn something where you are not starting out from a position of innocence and virtue, but complicity.
Well, thank you so much for all of that, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Esther Figueroa. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.